I want to welcome everyone to How to Write Engaging Copy for Speaker Proposals and Conferences. Is there a process somewhere? I want to remind everyone that today's conference is being recorded and an electronic recording is available to all registrants on the call. However, all the information presented is the property of Summit Consulting and Stevens Consulting Group, and any other recording or distribution of today's information without the express written consent is strictly prohibited. My name is Drew Stevens. I'm going to be your host for today's teleseminar. And I want to introduce you to Alan Weiss for those who are unfamiliar that have logged in from the blog posting and some of the other reference points. I want to introduce you to the fact that speakers sometimes are banal in approaching meeting directors. And with the introduction of new competitors, our interview today focuses on actions, rules, and processes for higher value. Again, my guest is Alan Weiss. Alan is one of those rare people who can say he's a consultant, speaker, and author and mean it. His consulting firm, Summit Consulting Group, has attracted clients such as Merck, Hewlett-Packard, GE, Mercedes-Benz, State Street Corporation, and over 500 leading organizations. His speaking typically includes 30 keynotes a year at major conferences, and he holds the record for selling out the highest-priced workshop on entrepreneurialism in the 21-year history of New York City's Learning Annex. He is an inductee into the Professional Speaking Hall of Fame and the concurrent recipient of the National Speakers Association Council of Peers Award of Excellence, representing the top 1% of professional speakers in the world. He's been named a Fellow of the Institute of Management Consultants, one of only two people in the history holding both designations. His prolific publishing includes over 500 articles and 35 books, including the bestseller Million Dollar Consulting, now in its fourth edition, and his latest, Thrive, Stop Wishing Your Life Away. Alan, welcome to the conference today.
Hey, Drew, why don't you just keep going? I like that.
You know what? We have a lot of questions that many participants have sent in, and everyone is thriving and waiting for your content, so I want to get started right away.
Well, I'm sitting here with Buddy Beagle, and so whatever I can't answer, I'm sure he'll take on.
Fantastic. Alan, you know, strong brands build multiple entry points. Why such an imperative portion of the accelerant curve, and how can it help those that are listening today?
Now, Drew, you broke up there for a minute. Would you ask me that again, please?
I certainly will. Speaking is an important part of the accelerant curve. Why should those listening to today use speaking as part of that curve?
Oh, well, look, there's two different components to speaking for the all the people who are listening. One is it's a great marketing technique, and the second is it can be a great revenue technique. You can do one or both. It's hard to do the second and not the first, but you can do the first and not the second. So in answer to your question, if you wish to market your services, whether you're an interior designer, you're an architect, you own a dental practice, you're a cosmetic dentist, you're a consultant, you're a speaker, you're a facilitator, doesn't matter. If you want to market it, you get out there and speak for free. Speak wherever you can. And that's generally the advice you give to new speakers anyway, get out and speak for free.
Right.
But by speaking for free, you get people in front of you, if you're judicious in the assignments you choose, who are recommenders and purchasers. So on the accelerant curve that you're talking about, and the accelerant curve just briefly means that on the left upper hand side, there's high ease of entry to work with you and little revenue. On the bottom right, there is high revenue, and it's a much more intimate experience. So by speaking for free to market, it's ease of entry. People get to hear you, and you get exposed. Now, if you're interested in professional speaking, which are, you know, the credentials you talked about with me a few minutes ago, then it could be a major revenue source. Keynote speakers, few and far between, non-celebrity, by the way, still can demand high amounts, but most of the money in speaking today is being made by trainers and people who are teaching things in workshops, and there's a lot of money to be made there. And consequently, when you do that, you can't help but market yourself as well. So there's the accelerant curve marketing aspect on the left, and then more midway through, there's this revenue generation from professional speaking.
Excellent. There are two methods for speaking. As you mentioned, you know, there are two components as to the why. Then there's the how. There is the typical bromide of the RFP. And then there's the second, which you offer in your book, Breaking Through the Writer's Block, which uses direct inquiry to executive directors. Do you have a process for approaching those executive directors?
Now, if you want to approach the executive director of a trade association, which is a very good source because they use speakers and they have audiences who can purchase and recommend from you in addition to that, and they also have boards of directors who constitute your buyers. If you want to approach them, my suggestion, the ideal way to do this, you know, the 10 on the 10 would be outside of a personal reference. You send them a one-page letter of inquiry. You enclose your press kit. I prefer to see this hard copy, by the way, not electronic. I'll tell you in a minute. You enclose a demo video, and you cite a specific conference that they're going to host and what you would do for their audience. And so in resources such as National Trade and Professional Associations in the United States, you can find the 10,000 associations in the U.S. You can find out who the executive director is, how many conferences they run, what their budget is, who their membership is, whether they use outside speakers, the whole ball of wax. And you say something like this: I'm interested in speaking in May at your annual conference on global leadership in a virtual economy. Your participant would receive the following benefits. And you list five bullet points: become better and maximize their chance for promotion internationally. Galvanize people, build their morale and build their commitment, even though you rarely physically are in their presence, and so forth and so on. You have a section on your credentials. Your demo video is enclosed. Testimonials are enclosed. And you say, I'll follow up Friday at 10 o'clock. And that executive director will say one of three things to you. That person will say, a lot of ambient noise. That person will say, look, I'm happy to talk to you, or I'd like you to talk to our program vice president, which is fine, or they just won't get back to you. But that's a very effective way of not having to go through middlemen, not having to go through bureaus to reach these executive directors. And you know, when I spoke, for example, for the National Fisheries Institute, not only did I get a keynote fee from them, but I did work for two of the firms represented in the audience.
Okay, we were talking about the processes, and one of the things I want to pick up on is the fact that you had mentioned a direct letter of inquiry, hard copy, versus electronic, and I think we just broke out there a little bit when we had the technical glitch, so I want to pick it up from there.
Sure. The reason for hard copy is that if you FedEx something, which will cost you, with the package I'm talking about, $17 or $21, if you FedEx it, nobody's going to throw it out. There's no gatekeeper or secretary is going to throw it out. It's going to be open, and you'll have your stuff, the fabric of your material, the color of your materials, things that you might want to enclose, like a book you've written or a booklet you've written or some product you want to enclose. You can't do that electronically. And people get so much electronic mail these days that it gets lost, and it doesn't stand out in the crowd. You know, one of the things that people in the social media platforms tell you is that they're so good because they amplify things. Well, the trouble is they amplify everything. And when everything's amplified, nothing's amplified. And so how do you stand out in a crowd these days? Ironically, you get on the old Pony Express again. You send the thing by FedEx, and you're more likely to get a hearing.
Hmm. Now, so what you're suggesting then is utilizing this direct approach and not a general inquiry to an RFP that some of these conferences then have.
Well, ignore RFPs. Well, first of all, very few conferences use RFPs. That's rather unusual in the speaking business. But RFPs are just meat markets. So a request for proposal, which is what an RFP is, it is simply put out by low-level people in some committee, and they want to see people's credentials without having to talk to them, and they make stupid decisions. They decide things on all the wrong terms. If you're a professional speaker, or if you're serious in marketing your services, you need to talk to the people making the decisions. You can't allow yourself to get in these time-consuming and really insipid discussions with low-level people.
I recently interviewed your friend and a great colleague, Patricia Fripp, on presentation skills, and she mentioned that she worries all of the time during your workshops on The Odd Couple about having manuals. So the manual's there, and Fripp went into a tremendous amount, and she says, and there's Alan, and he shows up with the entire course on a matchbook. What rules or actions do you have for writing copy and lessening labor? What rules or Alan's actions, as it were, do you have for writing copy and lessening labor?
Well, writing copy for whom, Drew?
For these executive directors.
Ah, thank you. That clarifies it.
Pardon.
What you want to do is keep it very, very succinct. And so think of one page. And even if you want to do it electronically, think of one screen. these people aren't going to read much anyway. And so what you want to do is say, right at the outset, I mean, don't do these rhetorical lateral arabesques, you know, which start out by saying something like this. In this day and age of increasing technology and less human contact, wouldn't it be nice if, good night, you know, I'm burning that one. So what you want to say immediately is, you know, dear Ms. Jones, I'm writing with the intent of contributing to your May conference on internationalization and globalizing small businesses. Specifically, my talk would be entitled, How to Take Main Street to Every Street, and your participants would benefit from the following. How to sell previously unthinkable items on an international scale. How to ensure that receipts are received in U.S. currency quickly and accurately. How to enter alliances with locally based firms, and so forth and so on. And then you say, my credentials for this are that I've worked with small business for 17 years, have earned the Small Business Award of the Northeast Chamber of Commerce's, have published two books in the area, you know, whatever it is. And then you say, thanks for your consideration. I'll call you Tuesday at 3 o'clock. And Tuesday at 3 o'clock, that all fits on one page. Tuesday at 3 o'clock, you call. And no matter to whom you speak, electronically or humanly, you say, I'm calling as promised.
Okay.
And you keep following up. So that's the brevity of the copy. You referred to my book before, Breaking Through Writer's Block. There are examples in there. And so it's not the quantity, it's the quality of what you're saying. And you always have to put yourself in the reader's position. These executive directors are evaluated on how well they educate the membership. And that's why a demo video is important, because they want some assurance that you can sustain a speech, by the way. But they also want to see in this letter how people will improve.
Your CD, Power Writing, mentions the use of metaphors and analogies. How might these be used in creating both titles and then copy?
Well, when you create any kind of example, any kind of verbal example, you save yourself about 4,000 words, and you also tend to embrace the reader if they accept your example or analogy in the picture. So if I were to say to someone, look, I want to talk about the necessity of health providers building community, and they should be building community to engage people in preventive actions for their own good health, which will eliminate costly contingent actions to take care of ill health. An example would be creating applications for the iPhone. The more applications, the more the iPhone is popular. The more the iPhone is popular, the more people write applications. The more applications, the more high-level, valuable people enter that community. The more applications written, the more they advance the iPhone. The same thing would apply to your health community. What you need is this kind of reciprocity of value. Now, if that person's using an iPhone or is familiar with apps, you're going to engross them in that conversation.
How often does that power writing also utilizes the example of writing with a book? How
Drew, of writing what?
I apologize. Power writing the CD also utilizes writing with a hook.
A hook, right? Thank you.
How might a hook assist in either a title or in a description?
Well, everything these days has to arise above the cacophony I talked about earlier. So, for example, if you want to write about strategy, or you want to talk about strategy, instead of saying, my speech is taking a strategic look, how to see well into the future, think about what might get somebody's attention above the sort of, mundane and insipid there, and say something like this. Far-reaching strategy, how to see what the competition can't. Or hidden strategy, how to see around the corners. Or sticking your head above the din, strategy with a periscope. Now, some of those might appeal to some of you and some might not, but that's what you have to do to gain attention. And the more that you use some kind of device that gains people's interest, makes them laugh, makes them say, I never looked at it that way, makes them say, that's a good example, the more you're going to be heard, the more you're going to be read. And what I just did takes about 10 seconds of thought. Now, if you feel blank, you know, and that's why my book's called Breaking Through Writer's Block, but if you feel blank, then just chat with somebody about it. I'm trying to do this, what do you think? Talk to your wife, talk to your husband, talk to your significant other, talk to a colleague, talk to your mastermind group. I talk to Koufax and Buddy Beagle all the time. They have great ideas.
As you were speaking, I'm reminded of the story of Million Dollar Consulting. When you and your editor, or the agent, if I recall, were trying to think of a better title for the book at the time, how did you eventually have now incorporated Million Dollar Consulting into a brand in many products that you have? How might speakers incorporate their brand into a title or even the description copy without sounding unctuous?
Well, two issues here. First of all, if you don't blow your own horn, there is no music. And so one of my workshops is called Shameless Promotion, and I'm shameless about saying that. You have to aggressively promote yourself. So, you know, if there's a guy on your shoulder, and he's always a guy, whispering in your ear, you can't do that in polite company. You have a hell of a nerve doing that. You have no right to say that. You need to get past him before you get past anywhere else. And so you got to flick him off your shoulder, and when he lands on the floor, you got to stomp on him until he's dead and bleeding. The second point, though, is this. When I was sitting with the senior editor of McGraw-Hill, the book was still called Confessions of a Consultant, which had, you know, it grossly changed. And it was about to go into production the next day, literally. And she said, Betsy Brown said, Alan, we need a title. And I said, I'll think about it. And she said, you are not leaving my office until you give me a title. It goes into production tomorrow. And I said, Betsy, for God's sakes, it's just about Million Dollar Consulting and how you do that. I said to her, it's about how I made $1 million consulting. And she said, that's the name of the book. And so sometimes it's right under your nose. And what you have to think about aren't just cutesy phrases and wild metaphors, but something that's highly descriptive. Now, Million Dollar Consulting is in its fourth edition. It sold 450,000 copies of something since 92. It's almost unprecedented for a book to be on the shelves of that nature for 17 years. And we were talking about what color is your parachute and so forth. Yet somebody comes up with a book called, How to Do Six-Figure Consulting. Now, why would you do something like that when Million Dollar Consulting is out there? How to Do Six-Figure Consulting. So you have to do something that is attractive and current and powerful. So you take your brand, if you have one, or you use the book to create a brand. I mean, as soon as that book came out, I realized I had a very powerful brand. And that's stupid. And you incorporate it into what you do. So let's just say that you've been engaged with leadership for a long time, and you've noticed that the rubric about leadership starting at the top or leadership starting at the bottom, you know, you have to have good followers to be a good leader, and all of this nonsense, you've noticed that it actually starts in the middle. And you say, you know something, my book or my speech, my approach is going to be called Leadership from the Middle. Now, I'll tell you something. If somebody did that, they had a speech title or a book title or an article title, I would at least be curious enough to find out what the heck they were talking about.
Interesting. I want to just take a quick pause here because I am starting to get some questions from the inbox. And again, I will ask all of our listeners today, number one, those logging in late, if you could please hit *6, that will mute you. If you do have questions, you can send them to our operators and engineers. They're standing by. They are at the inbox at drew@stevensconsultinggroup.com. And Alan, Beverly did have a question where you had mentioned a source for executive directors of trade associations. If you could please repeat that source.
National Trade and Professional Associations of the United States is in hard copy and it's electronic. You can find it in libraries, I believe, as a reference work. Of course, you can't take it out unless you steal it. But otherwise, you can buy it hard copy or you can subscribe online. If you go to my blog, contrarianconsulting.com, that makes you part of my community. I talked about communities before. And if you hit the search function on there, you will find that I've referenced the book with a link as to how you can get it with a discount using your connection with me. So you get about a 20% discount whether you buy the book physically or you access it online. So just go to my blog, look it up in the search function, and you can get a discount if you're interested.
And
Drew, by the way, I have no financial interest in that. I have no connection with it. That's just a public service for my community.
And if I recall, those that are members of Alan's Forums, which is another community you've developed, and you were the social media king before they even developed social media, as it were. But those that are in Alan's Forums, if I recall, Alan, there is a mention of that particular reference in the forums, too.
Yeah, it's also on alansforums.com, but that's a private community. You have to be a member. That's right.
Right. So to pick this back up where we were previously, you were doing a couple of things with title development just before that quick break, and wanted to know if you have a process for title development, and what are your most successful titles, and why is that so?
Well, my feeling is this. I spend about, 30 to 60 seconds on a title. Nothing more than that. I mean, what Fripp said before, which he said to you in the interview, is absolutely true. She prepares for The Odd Couple for the prior 2 months, and I prepare, in the elevator on the way down, which means if I'm staying on the 36th floor, I have pretty good material. But if I'm staying on the 4th floor, I come in kind of shaky. So I spend very little time coming up with titles, but what I do is I cut right to the chase, and I say to myself, what would cause somebody to look at this? Like Leadership from the Middle. It sounds absurd, but what would cause somebody to look at this? And so let me see if I can give you an example of something that's more more pragmatic and up-to-date here. When I was writing my book, Thrive, actually, in a book, obviously, you have a lot of things you have to look at. You have a lot of chapters you have to write, and there's a lot to put together. So let me see if I can give you an example of what this looks like. So in the first chapter in Thrive, I wanted to get people thinking about why they wished so much. I think people wish too much instead of actually taking plans. And so I said, wish, wish, wish. Well, how is that word used? Well, when you wish upon a star. So I said, fine, because that's very popular from Disney and everything. And I said, well, when you wish upon a star, you're probably psychotic. And so what I do is I try to take something standard and use it with humor. And I go on to point out that wishing upon a star was promulgated by a cricket, if you recall correctly, Jiminy Cricket. In another instance in here, I said, well, how about a comparison? And in another chapter, I wanted to give an example of why wishing is really not very fulfilling in the long run. Now, I remembered a book a long time ago called military music is the music. That was the analogy, So the idea is military music is not very good music, and neither was this. And so I said, well, how can I use a comparison like that? And I said, wishing is to achievement, the way watching TV is to aerobic fitness. Dreams make you fat. One more example. I wanted to talk about people who, they think that wishing and dreaming will get them somewhere, I thought of another song, Over the Rainbow, and I said, somewhere over the rainbow are tons of bluebird droppings. And I said, happy little bluebirds can fly because they have wings. You can't put wings on a goat and get a flying goat. And so I play around with titles that way for my speaking, for my writing, using things that people can relate to and then pulling a double whammy. I sort of yank the rug out from under them. So when I say, on a more serious vein, looking strategic thinking or looking into the future, how to see what the competition can't, the first part of it is, strategy. But the second is, wow, I'd love to see what the competition can't. That's really interesting. When I talk about value-based fees, I talk about why you're over-delivering and undercharging. And so anybody who reads that says, if there is a scintilla of possibility, if there is an iota of truth to the fact that I might be over-delivering and undercharging, I want to see what this guy has to say. I at least want to say he's dead wrong, but if he's at all right, I need to hear that. That's how you hook people.
So with titles, and you're not utilizing a lot of time here, you're suggesting then the basis of perhaps comparisons, or you're the master at the contrarian methodology. So are you suggesting the use of perhaps some contrarian contrarian methodology with some humor to gain that attention that would raise you above the bar from other speakers.
Yes, and you provide things that cause people to say, I really can't not listen to this or find out what it's about. One of my speeches on the keynote circuit, when I would give people a choice of five or six things, was called A Constantly Changing World. And, of course, that's kind of mundane. But then the subtitle was Seven Keys to a World That Will Never Be the Same. And, of course, when you read that, you say, well, what are the seven keys? Is it the same seven keys that I'm thinking of? What is that? I tell you a funny story. When I got this award you talked about, when I was inducted into the Professional Speaker Hall of Fame, they inducted five people that night. And you have an introducer who you choose. And my introducer walked up there, and he said the darndest thing. You know, I mean, there were 3,500 or 3,200 people in the National Speakers Association, and every single one of them thinks they're brilliant, right? And he says, there are only three geniuses in the National Speakers Association, and Alan Weiss is one of them. Now, everybody in that audience would say, well, the speaker thinks he's one, and if Alan Weiss is the second, am I the third? He just galvanized their attention. I thought it was one of the funniest things I had ever heard. Because all of a sudden, everybody was sitting up looking around. And so whenever you say something like four reasons, nine myths, six cases, people want to see if that's congruent with the number they would come up with.
In today's world, with social media and many of the blog postings, words such as secrets or myths seem to rise above the cacophony, and you had mentioned some of that just now. Are there some specific words or even verbs that must or even should be used to capture some of that interest?
Well, I mean, the amplification and the cacophony is real, but the fact is that you want to use action words. You want to use a dramatic words to get people to think. Don't tell people you want to help them grow the business. Tell people you want to dramatically accelerate their business. Things like turbocharge to become rather passe because people use it all the time. But it's still better than saying, you know, I want to move you ahead, you know, quickly. I'm working with somebody on a concept that he calls a fearless growth. I'm working with another person on a concept he calls outrageous growth. Those are great terms. Just fabulous terms. And so you can use any number of adjectives, but they have to cause people to think and be stimulated and move to action. And, you know, there's a difference. When I actually teach presentation skills, which I do, and I run this a program called Speaking with Alan, I show the difference between power language and non-power language. Power language uses action verbs, not passive verbs. It uses a call to action, not a suggestion to action. And it uses the dynamics of the language. You know, when I do this, Alan's Monday morning memo comes out every Monday morning, obviously.
Right.
And the quote I put in this last one is one of my very favorites. It's by Wittgenstein. And what he said is, the limits of my language is the limit of my world. And consequently, the wider your vocabulary, the wider your world. The more narrow or limited your vocabulary, the more limited your world. And so with speaking titles, with titles of articles or books, whatever it is you're looking at, the more varied and powerful language you use, the more appeal you're going to have.
And you and I have discussed this. We've discussed it in Million Dollar Consulting College, and you talk about this quite often. For those that are unfamiliar with your thoughts on this, I just want you to spend a moment or two on it, and that is exactly what you said, the power of vocabulary. There are many out there that have been taught to write on a sixth grade level or an eighth grade level, and I know you have very strict opinion on that, and if you could just provide that to those that are unfamiliar with that information.
Somebody just raised this with me yesterday, and I nearly got violent again. They just raised it as a question.
Don't get violent here.
I get violent a lot, I find, usually when I'm not drinking. Look, the problem here is that the people who have told us to dumb down your attire and dumb down your language and so forth are basically very insecure, fairly incompetent, scared people. And by projection, they want to make us all descend to their level. Powerful people like powerful people. Successful people like successful people. I was talking to a bank president once, And he had one of his associates in his office, and in a sentence I used a word which he clearly didn't understand. He didn't stop me. While I was speaking, he turned around, got a dictionary, opened it up, clearly looked up that word as I was speaking, shrugged his shoulders, you know, closed the dictionary, went back to the conversation. That was a very, very confident act. You know, he said to him, he was saying to us, I don't know the word, I'm going to look it up, but I don't want to disturb your thought train. Powerful people do that. And so consequently, you never dumb down what you do. You treat your audience as intelligent adults. You never treat your listener as damaged. And once you say that they can't understand your language, you're treating them as damaged. People tell me all the time, they read my blog posts, they read my books, they read Balancing Act, my newsletter, they have to look up some of the words. I feel good about that. I'm helping them out. And so there's never a need to dumb down your language. It should be the farthest thing from your mind. And people who tell you to do that, run from. They don't know what they're talking about. There was a guy named Johnson O'Connor who he has created, they still run these testing labs across the United States. The headquarters in New York. And he actually has written on this. His contention was that by broadening IQ, you could actually, excuse me, by broadening vocabulary, you could actually increase IQ points. He wrote extensively on this, and one of the things that tells me whether I'm dealing with an intelligent person is their sense of humor, and another thing is the breadth of their vocabulary.
Excellent, and I'm a big advocate of that. You have a good host of vocabulary in the new book, Thrive, and I do suggest, if you're unfamiliar with it, as a student of Alan's, that if you haven't read his works, to have the dictionary there, and you will learn more. Picking this, going forward a little bit, Alan, you had mentioned things that really drive the provocation of the meeting planner or the executive director. In addition to your liking vocabulary, you also love quotes, and you mentioned one a few minutes ago. And another one of your favorite quotes is "hot as Georgia asphalt." And many marketers,
"hot as Georgia asphalt" in August.
In August, yes, I apologize. Marketers and advertisers constantly use imagery and use the senses for persuasive techniques. How might the use of those techniques help to arouse attention in writing the speaker proposal to these executive directors?
Well, when you're writing to someone who doesn't know you and doesn't know of your work, you don't have a strong brand, then the option you have is to get their attention quickly by captivating them. Now, how does an August day, how does asphalt on a Georgia, on an August day in Georgia, is an analogy. And it really brings to mind this very hot pavement, you know, that all of us, at least who have been in that kind of heat, have been accustomed to. Another favorite phrase I have, and this one I made up, I think I got that other one from a movie, by the way. I could picture Lorna Dern was in it. It was one of these wild, wild movies, Blue Velvet or something like that. Anyway, one of the phrases I've been using for 30 years is obvious as a ham sandwich. It's concise, it's quick, and a ham sandwich is one of the most obvious things in the world. I just love it. But it has a little tint of uncertainty to it. It has a little bit of unclarity to it, and that's why I love it too. So when you say things like that, people pay attention. What does he mean by that? What did she mean by that? And you get people to perk up. So rather than trying to explain things in 15 paragraphs of text, a few examples like that will really drill things home. A phrase I use all the time, which I first developed with Hewlett-Packard, is escape velocity. And I say to people, the trouble with your ideas not getting momentum, not getting traction, is that they have no escape velocity. You can't escape the gravity of the old, the tried, the true, the ossified, the calcified, the things that never change. You need escape velocity. If I told you, Drew, you needed escape velocity, what would your next question to me be?
How do I do that?
Exactly.
And if I remember, for those that are listening, you actually got two things out of that. Not only the phrase, but you got a process visual out of that, too. I remember the rocket ship as you're speaking.
The rocket ship was my process visual. That's right.
With that in mind, and using these words, there are kind of two things, and I'll run this on as a parallel course here. One of your favorite books or favorite things I've seen quoted is one of the authors, and goodness, I wrote it down, and I'm trying to look at my notes, and I can't remember right now, so I apologize. But one of the authors that you've read spend hours on sentences, and they meant nothing.
That's Proust. You're thinking of Remembrance of Things Past.
Yes, thank you. And I remember in my conversation with Fripp, and you're sparking this, is that Jerry Seinfeld works for hours as well on sentences and trying to keep them succinct in order to deliver a good line of humor. How important is it to spend a lot of time on this stuff, or is it just following your example of success, not perfection? In other words,
right now you're talking apples and aardvarks. You're talking two entirely different things. So let me clarify this. What Seinfeld does, one of the hardest things in the world to do is humor.
Mm-hmm.
And Seinfeld is one of the best I've ever seen, and I've seen him a couple of times in person. Humor is about cadence, among other things. And so, for example, I tell a lot of stories. Seinfeld does observational humor. I tell observational stories in my keynotes and so forth. And my stories are based on a very careful cadence. If you deconstruct what I do, there's a cadence to what I do. And that's what Seinfeld does, or it's what any good stand-up does, you know, who's worth his or her salt. So what he's practicing is economy. He's practicing getting something done in as little time as possible, but without missing, you know, the pith, without missing the real critical nature of what he wants to convey. However, the other case here, you know, the aardvark versus the apple, is that when you're writing something, then you have to think about success, not perfection. Seinfeld's going to be standing up, you know, getting paid $500,000 to do, you know, an hour or so or whatever he gets. He gets a little more than I do. And he needs to be good every time because of the reputation and because of these people who are going to sit in an audience and not going to sit still very much. You know, I've been to comedy clubs. That's the toughest audience in the world. On the other hand, when you're delivering a speech, people expect value and they expect information, and humor is just an extra added attraction. When you're writing, the same thing. So you don't have to be as careful about sentence structure and every word. So my feeling is, if something sounds good to you, go with it. Success, not perfection. And your original example here is apt, because Proust spent months, if you look at his work, he wrote in longhand, of course, and you open these his documents, his manuscripts, and you see these pages folded out and folded out. He spent 4 months working on a sentence, and Proust is turgid. I mean, he's just impossible to read. I mean, it's just a Remembrance of Things Past is awful literature. I care what anybody says. And it's unreadable. So, you know, less is more, in that the less you work on these things, the more effective they're going to be if you just keep in mind that you want to convey yourself effectively but not perfectly.
So with that, one of our listeners today wanted to know, you had mentioned earlier you spend just about 3 seconds on titles, but for those that don't have that rapt attention and don't have that fortitude, how much time should they spend on these titles and on speaker proposals?
Well, those are two different things. On a title of a speech, if I were you, I'd spend a minute. And if you get something good, move on. Not perfect, not ideal, good, move on. If you don't have it in a minute, then move on to other things you want to do and return to it later. Keep a pad, not an electronic gizmo, a pad, wherever you tend to get ideas, in your car, on your night table, at the dining room table, you know, on the pool table. Wherever it is that you tend to get ideas, keep a pad, because it'll come to you and you write it down. Use the technique I talked about before. Mention it to other people, get ideas from them. So don't labor over the title. Come up with it quickly, or it'll come to you later. But insofar as the other part, which is the letter to the executive director, that you should spend some time on so that it's quick, it's succinct, but it reads well. And if you're not sure about it, run that by someone else. I mean, people in my mentor program are always running, well, the smart ones, are always running those letters by me, and I can tell in you know, two-thirds of an instant whether or not they have a good chance of being read.
Is there any use of OMV? I know, and OMV, obviously, as a student of yours, is used mostly in proposal writing, but might some of that technology be utilized as a resource in writing these letters and in producing some of these descriptions for these executive directors?
Well, OMV stands for Objectives, Measures, and Value. You know, I did 5 videos this morning. I shot Writing on the Wall for the next 5 months. We did these 5 videos, and one of the videos, incidentally, was about the meaning of meaning and why meaning matters. And see, I don't tend to talk in initials. I don't talk about OMV, even though I really created it. I talk about Objectives, Measures, and Value. I don't talk about EB. I talk about the economic buyer, because it ensures. I don't know if there are 100 people on this line, but if 3 of them are unfamiliar with OMV, that's 3 too many. Mm-hmm. So I want to make sure that people always understand what I'm talking about, no matter where I am. And in terms of this letter you're talking about, Objectives, Measures, and Value would be overkill. All I would focus on are these 5 or 6 bullet points. Here are the results that your audience is going to receive. Here is how they'll be improved. Here is how their condition will be bettered. Here is why they will feel more effective. Here's why they'll be able to exponentially increase the power of what they do. Whatever it is, it's those results that are important in the context of that letter.
With some of the things that you're mentioning here as well, I'm just going to give this a slight twist because you're reminding me of something with the meaning of meaning. Might some of these principles that you're teaching today be utilized in writing articles for the same association, which is also another inroad that you can gain attention and, mind you, something that could be placed on someone's accelerant curve?
Sure. I mean, I'll give you a formula for writing an article in the next 60 seconds. Come up with a premise that you would like to convey. Develop a title and subtitle for the premise along the lines I talked about earlier. One of those could be humorous, but in some combination they have to be catchy and attractive. Then develop as many points as you wish to convey about the premise. It might be 4, it might be 6, it might be 10, whatever you want to do. You might be constrained by space or not constrained by space. Then write the 10 points, supported by your discussion as to why they're important and a contemporary example as to why they're important.
Yeah.
And then after you finish those 10 points or whatever, then you write a paragraph that's the opening paragraph, because now you know how your 10 points read, and then you write a paragraph that's your closing paragraph. Your opening paragraph should describe why the 10 points are important.
Well, no, actually, we'll send that to NCDF eventually.
And the closing paragraph should describe what you should do next to make it happen. So there's a 60-second formula on how to write an article for anyone.
Alan, as we conclude our session here today, are there any actions or best practices that you would like to leave our listeners and participants with today?
Well, let me leave you with one so that it will cause sort of an imprint instead of trying to create a cacophony myself and amplify all kinds of things. Let me just mention one that I think might help a great deal, and that's this. When you see a catchy title or copy that galvanizes your attention, rivets your attention, don't just say, that's really cool. Ask yourself why. Deconstruct it. Is the title a self-inflicted contradiction? Is it a paradox? Is it confrontational? Is it contrarian? Does it play on a standard theme and then change it radically? Does the copy take some contemporary event and turn it on its head? Is there something shocking about it that people didn't realize? Is there some hidden meaning? Whatever it is that has intrigued you, deconstruct it, and then don't copy that because that's derivative. You know, once Chicken Soup for the Soul came out, you know, people wrote turkey broth, you know, for the lower arteries. I mean, it was ridiculous. That's derivative and silly. However, don't copy the title. Copy the process. And whatever process worked in making that attractive, use that process in your own work.
And you had also mentioned, I wanted to follow up, I just wanted to give our listeners that are not as familiar with you as I queue up some additional questions here to conclude. You had mentioned having a pad around you, and I'm a big advocate of that. You mentioned it at Million Dollar Consulting. Could you just give a quick 30, 45 seconds on where you place your pads and why they're so important?
Well, I get ideas all the time, and I have a terrible memory. I have a great long-term memory. I have a bad short-term memory. Always had since I was young. And so I want to record things, and I cannot record things electronically quickly. I use an iPhone very deftly, And I use electronic. I am no Luddite. However, if you want to make a quick note, you need something to write it on. Now, the alternative would be the iPhone, for example, has a recording device on it. However, it depends what screen you're on and if your iPhone is turned on. And going through the motions of turning it on and finding the microphone on there and then recording it and then remembering it's there is not worth it, even though it's available. So I have pads in all my cars. I have three vehicles. Everyone has a pad in the console. There's a pad by my bed. There's a pad all over my den. And they're also at various places around the house. I mean, not obviously, but, for example, behind the bar in the pool room, there's a pad along with the liquor in case I think of something while I'm drinking, which is not at all uncommon.
Keeps you looser if nothing else.
Yeah, the trouble is I can't always read my handwriting.
I am looking at some questions, and Lisa has just asked me a question, and that is, what questions, if any, should I ask any of the board members to ensure that I include industry dynamics into the presentation that I would be giving when accepted?
Well, don't forget, you have two objectives with a board member. One is to get their inputs for the speech or the project, but the second is to see if you can establish a relationship whereby you can do business with their company, because they're probably the CEO or top officer of another company, constituting a prospect for you. So I would ask something like this: what are the hot buttons, the major issues in the industry today that you see needing to be addressed? What are the priorities? I'd also ask, what do you see coming down the road? What's approaching that you think needs to be addressed that isn't getting proper attention, that's getting lost in the din? And I'd also ask them that something like this: at your position in this industry, if you had your choice, what legacy would you want to leave?
So you're using with that some of the questions that you have. And those unfamiliar, you have 100 questions in Breaking Through the Writer's Block, as well as Million Dollar Consulting College, and that is 100 questions focused on objectives, questions with the prospective buyer, and so on.
Any final thoughts before we end our time with the listeners today?
If you're looking to create copy strictly to people who are in the copywriting profession, what you want is something more original. And so look around for things that really attract you in the environment, and copy the process that made them so effective for you. What I was saying earlier. But be careful to whom you listen. You want someone who uses these titles in their work, not somebody who just creates them for a living.
Alan, you also, for those that are on the call today, you have some up-and-coming events. If you want to let our listeners know about those.
Well, my teleconference series starts in March, and there are 10 of those this year, March through December. Very, very popular. One of the most popular things I do. The Million Dollar Consulting College is in March, March 22nd in Newport. I'm doing a program on process visuals, which you talked about before, February 3rd here in the Providence, Rhode Island area. I've got three things coming up if you follow my website and my blog. We've just launched something called the New Product Experience.
That's one of my old bosses.
Which is how to launch new products, and it's a very, very sophisticated experience.
Thank you for your time today and your expertise, and I want to thank all of our registrants for today. I don't want to remind everyone that Alan's latest book, Thrive, is available at Amazon.com. If you haven't picked up a copy, it is available there. If you haven't had an opportunity to write a review, please do so. He also has the fourth edition of Million Dollar Consulting that is now out by McGraw-Hill. And Alan, you also have a new book, which I believe came out late year with one of your students and mentor proteges, Nancy McKay, The Talent Advantage as well.
That's right. Nancy and I wrote The Talent Advantage, and then Gershon Mader and Josh Lieber and I also wrote a book that just came out from Amazon, called The Power of Strategic Commitment.
For those of you that are unfamiliar with where to reach Alan, his daily blog is found, as he mentioned before, if you didn't catch it, it's contrarianconsulting.com. His website for additional products and speaking appearances can be found at summitconsulting.com. And if you seek community with Alan, as he mentioned before, it is a private community. You must get a hold of him to do so. And he's got one of the largest consulting communities in the world. You can find that at alansforums.com, but please write him a separate email. Alan, again, I want to thank you so much for your time and your content today.
My pleasure, Drew. Thank you for asking me.
And I want to thank you all again. Remember, if you want to thrive in your business, you have to get out of the stands and into the field of play. This is Dr. Drew. I want to thank you all today and make it a day full of results.